The invitation. So today I'm going to talk about phenomenological aspects of emergent phenomena, and this work here has been done in collaboration with John Donohue and Ofuk Aydemir for the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And please feel free to interrupt me any moment or even criticize this work. So this is a very brief outline of my talk. First of all, I will explain what I mean by emergence and why I'm considering the emergence. And then I will concentrate my talk on the emergence of symmetries, and I will present some phenomenological procedures that we might use in order to study the emergent phenomena. So first of all, let me, just in a few minutes, explain what I mean by emergence. So throughout the history of the mankind, people used to think in reductionism. And from this principle, people came to break the big systems into smaller parts. So we break the human body into organisms, into cells, into molecules, into atoms, and finally into elementary particles. So as we go from this direction to this direction, this is what we mean by reductionism. However, there is another way, which is to go from this direction to the other direction. And this is what we mean by emergence. And because of that, people tend to define emergence. So as we go from this, from each layer to the other, we find actually that there are new properties of matter that emerge that they were not there to begin with. And because of that, people define emergence as a way where certain patterns arise out of the constituent parts of a system that do not have these parts to begin with. This is a brief description of emergence. Of course, emergence happens in every field, from physics to biology to chemistry, even to social sciences. However, today, I'm going to talk about emergence in physics. And we know that there are actually properties of matter like temperature, friction, color, viscosity, or even Navier-Stokes equations that don't make any sense if we consider like an atom or a molecule. And these properties can be thought of as emergent properties of matter. So, for example, if we have the water molecule, which consists of two hydrogen and one oxygen atoms, it doesn't make any sense to talk about the color of the atoms in this molecule, or about the friction between two atoms. However, as we consider the huge number of atoms or molecules, then these properties like viscosity or the color start to make sense. So all these properties are emergent properties. Today I'm going to talk about the emergence as a whole in physics. I'm going to concentrate my talk on the emergence of symmetries, and as we know that symmetries play a prominent role in describing many physical phenomena. So why I want to study the emergence? The first reason that actually emergence is an alternative way to unification. Usually people, when they unify, as they go to higher and higher energies, they consider bigger and bigger symmetries. And actually, the claim is that there are some historical evidence for this to that happened before, like Maxwell, for example. People consider that Maxwell brought electricity and magnetism in what we call the electromagnetic theory. Also, Blaschot, Weinberg, and Lamm, they actually brought together the electromagnetic sector and the weak sector into what we call the electroweak sector. And because of that, people think, okay, why not we embed these symmetry groups into higher groups like SU5, for example, or even if you want to include gravity, then we consider something like string theory. But actually, one has to bear in mind that Maxwell never unified electricity and magnetism. All Maxwell did actually that he identified the different parts of the U1 gauge group. Also, Blaschot, Weinberg, and Salam didn't unify electricity and the weak theory. They just considered the mixing between the two gauge sectors. So because of that, the proper way that I define unification is to take
these groups, like the standard model groups, and the, we embed them in a higher group, like SU5 or SU10. This is the proper way of thinking about unification. And unfortunately, we don't have a historical precedent for this before. The other reason why I am considering emergence is that it happens all the time in condensed matter systems. So people in condensed matter systems could talk about phonons, magnons, and other excitations like particles. And these excitations behave like particles. But these excitations make only sense when we consider huge number of atoms or molecules together. And there is no any concept of phonon, for example, in the interatomic or intermolecular system. All right. So what is the dream of emergence? And this is the dream postulated by Holger Nielsen. So let us assume that the world or the universe at very high energy scale, or what we call the emergent scale, is actually very chaotic, very random world. There are no any symmetries. Just you can think in terms, if you would like to think in terms of the effective field theory, write down the most general Lagrangian, the ugliest Lagrangian that doesn't respect any kind of symmetry. And then as you run down from the UV to the IR, what will happen is that only these excitations that are protected by emergent symmetries will be protected and will be there, which I mean the standard model of particle physics. And if you want also to include gravity in this sense, this time itself has to also be emergent. So there is no meaning of talking about even manifold at very high energy scale. Manifold makes sense only as a low energy emergent. At low energy scale. All right. So actually, there are two approaches to the emergence. The first one is the top-down approach that I am not going to talk about today. And there are a few examples, like string net condensation causal theory or Hujava-Lipschitz theory of gravity. This is the top-down approach that I'm not going to touch on today. However, what I am going to talk about is the bottom-up approach. Again, I will be talking about the emergence of symmetries, and I will present phenomenological procedure to study the emergence. So these are the main points of my talk. First, I will talk about the constraints on emergent theories, and then I will describe some of the phenomenological procedure that we can actually use in order to study the emergence. And in particular, I will introduce phenomenological models to study the emergence of a universal limiting speed or the emergence of Lorentz symmetry in the IR. And also, I will study the emergence of gauge symmetries in nature. And I will put some constraints on the breaking of these gauge symmetries in nature. All right. So let me start first with the constraints on emergent theories. The first constraint on emergent theories comes from Witten or Weinberg-Witten theory, which actually was used at the beginning as a no-go theory for emergent theories. So this theory says that there is no consistent quantum field theory that satisfies the following three criteria. Actually, there are two versions for the theory, the version for the internal symmetries and version for the space-time symmetries. So let me start with the version for the internal symmetries. So the theory says that there is no consistent quantum field theory for spin greater than or equal to one that satisfies the following three criteria. First, that the theory has a conserved current. By this current, we mean the Noether current. This current has to be carried by the field. In other words, that the theory has to be nonlinear. And this current has to be Lorentz invariant. And the three requirement is that the theory has massless excitation. So any theory that satisfies these three criteria cannot be self-consistent. The other version of the Weinberg-Witten theory is for space-time symmetries. And This theory says that, again, no consistent quantum field theory with this being greater than or equal to 2 that satisfies the following three criteria. First of all, that there is conserved current, Noether current again, which results by because of the invariance under time and translation invariance of the space. And the way we can get this Noether current is the usual way to get the energy momentum tensor for any theory. For example, in the case of the gravity, we take our Lagrangian, which is the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, and we take the derivative with respect to the metric tensor G mu nu. And if you want to consider the Minkowskian background, you just expand G mu nu around, you write it down like eta mu nu plus H mu nu. All right. So this is the first requirement. The second requirement that eta mu nu is Lorentz invariant. And the third, that the theory has massless excitation. So again, if the theory satisfies the following three criteria, the theory cannot be consistent. But this is disaster. Why? Because this theory tells us that there cannot be gluons or gravitons in nature.
Photons, not, because actually,
if you go back to the first version of the theory, that the field has to be carried by the field. In other words, the theory has to interact with itself. So there should be some nonlinear term in the theory. So the electromagnetic theory, like, evades this requirement. All right. So in order to evade Weinberg-Witten theory, there are a few things that we can do. The first thing is the usual way we which is the existence of a fundamental gauge symmetry in our theory, like UN internal gauge symmetry, all right, or the diffeomorphism invariance in the case of gravity. So what happens if we have the fundamental gauge invariance? For example, in the case of gravity, if you try to transform H mu nu, which looks like a tensor, you will find that H mu nu goes to H mu nu, but it also breaks some residual terms due to the fundamental gauge invariance of the theory. And hence, H mu nu fails actually to be a Ginian Lorentz, a Ginian tensor under Lorentz transformation. So if you go back to the theory, if H mu nu, or in other words, G mu nu, is not a Ginian tensor under Lorentz transformation, then the mu nu is not also a Ginian tensor, and in this case, we violate requirement number 2. In other words, that the gauge invariance actually tells us that there are only 2 physical polarizations in H mu nu, although H mu nu has 10 components. All right, so this is the usual way how it works, like in the case of U1 gauge fields or in the case of gravity. The other way to evade Weinberg-Witten theory is actually to assume that Lorentz symmetry itself is emergent. And in this case, we actually consider non-relativistic gluons and the gravitons. And the third way to evade the Weinberg-Witten theory is to assume that the space-time itself is emergent.
Yeah, okay, perfect.
Okay, if you write down the G mu, which is the current for the gluons, you find that this current actually is not gauge invariant. So it breaks the component mu, so you can write it down like mu f mu nu. So under Lorentz transformation, mu goes to mu plus some residual term. And hence mu in this case is not a Ginian Lorentz vector.
Thing is not
Exactly. Yes. All right. So, what is the second? So, this is the first constraint is within Weinberg theory. What is the other constraint on emergent theories? The other constraint is the existence of a universal Lorentz symmetry. Actually, it is kind of easy to come up some theory where different species have different Lorentz invariants. However, it is extremely difficult to come up with a model where all the different species have exactly the same limiting speed.
So this is the second constraint on emergent theories. And the third constraint comes from Nielsen Ninomiya no-go theory, which says that you cannot actually put chiral fermions on a lattice. So this is bad news for people who try to build theories that are discrete in nature, because at the end of the day, we know that our standard model is chiral. So these are the main three constraints on emergent theories. So right now, as I have just told you, I'm not going to build up fundamental theory of emergence. Rather, I will try to take some phenomenological approach to study the phenomenological, to study the emergent phenomena. And in order to be clear of what I am going to do in the next 40 minutes or so, let me give this very simple example from condensed matter physics, where I exhibit these two points that I will show that some symmetries are emergent, and also I will show that although these symmetries are emergent, there could be some residual effects that violate the symmetry. Small residual effects. And this is the example of the emergence of phonons on a lattice. So let us take a lattice with a huge number of atoms, and let us assume that the potential between two any atoms is actually a function of the distance between the atoms. Then Taylor expand, and we will find that the second term and the fourth term will survive. There could be also higher order terms, and we assume that there is some symmetry that forbids the linear and the cubic term. All right, so this is the Lagrangian for the discrete system, and all we need to do is just to go to the continuum limit. So you just send the I to X, and the amplitude of the fluctuations, yi, you send it to phi. And at the end of the day, you get this Lagrangian. So the first part of the Lagrangian is just the Klein-Gordon equation, where the speed of light is delayed by the speed of sound. So this is an example of an emergent Lorentz symmetry in condensed matter system. But however, there is also the quartic term. So there is actually some small violation for Lorentz symmetry. So this is an example that actually it is kind of easy to obtain emergent Lorentz symmetry at the IR in condensed matter systems. So first of all, I will try to explain that if you try to do the same for the magnums, for example, you get also Klein-Gordon equation, but with a different speed of light. So now the question, how we can justify that there is a universal speed of light as we observe it in our world. And the other way, and the other thing that I'm going to do is actually to estimate the small violation from the exact symmetry. I'm not going to study the small deviation from Lorentz symmetry. I'm going to actually study the small deviation from the gauge symmetry in this case, because we will have studied before the small deviation from Lorentz symmetry.
So this, in some sense, summarizes what I am going to do.
So let me start with the first part, with which is the existence of a universal limiting speed. As I have just mentioned, it is kind of easy for different particles to obey a relativistic dispersion relation. What is not easy is that to force all these particles to have exactly the same emergent speed. So if we actually parameterize the difference between one and the ratio between the speed of electrons, for example, and the speed of photons by the parameter eta, we find that astrophysical bounds that come from Cherenkov radiation and synchrotron emission can limit eta to of order 10 to minus 14 or so, which is extremely small and a true challenge for model builders. Actually, Hujava in his review on his gravity, which is an emergent theory of gravity where the gravitons are actually non-relativistic in the UV and they just emerge in the IR as relativistic gravitons, he says the following. The biggest challenge for this program is to explain why the infrared limit should exhibit Lorentz invariance to the high level of accuracy required by observation. While the theory may naturally flow to Z equal to 1 at long distances, different species of low energy probes may experience distinct effective limiting speed of propagation not equal to the speed of light. Setting all these speeds equal to C would represent a rather unpleasant amount of fine tuning. So that is true. In the absence of any form of interaction between the particles, these speeds are frozen and different. However, let us not to forget that in general, different fields interact and they influence each other's propagation velocity. So if we write down our Lagrangian at some UV or emergent scale as the kinetic term, plus interaction Lagrangian, we find that this interaction Lagrangian is actually a function not only of the couplings, but also as a function of the different propagating speeds. And according to the Wilsonian renormalization group, the same Lagrangian should describe the same system at different energy scales. Actually, in Lorentz invariant theories, we find that Lorentz symmetry prevents renormalization of the speed, and one can set C equal to 1 from the beginning as a definition of natural units. However, if the different species have different speeds, then one has to treat these speeds exactly as the same way we treat the coupling constants between the different species. So actually, in our work with John Donohue, we consider different types of interaction, Yukawa, U1, SUN. And in all cases, we showed actually that there is a stable IR fixed line at a universal speed of light. In other words, we found that actually we can visualize Lorentz symmetry as an emergent symmetry in the IR. So let us consider the following simple example, which we call the non-covariant gauge invariant QED. So this is exactly the usual QED Lagrangian. All we have done here is just we restored the different speeds, CG for the speed of light here and here, and CF for the speed of the fermions. Now, in order to find the renormalization group, all we need to do is just to calculate one loop effect. The propagators are just the textbook propagators, and all we need to do is just to restore the speed of light for the photons and the speed of light for the fermions. And after a few steps, we find that this is the beta function of our system. And by inspection, we find here that CF equal to CG is a fixed point or a fixed line for this system. And one can study the stability of this fixed point by studying the Jacobian or the eigenvalues at CF equal to CG to actually find that CF equal to CG is an IR attractive fixed line, or in other words, that Lorentz symmetry is actually an emergent symmetry in the IR. Yes.
So you have a completely destroyed Lorentz invariance.
Exactly, yeah.
What symmetries is it still there?
Only the gauge invariance. Only the gauge invariance.
So all you demand is gauge invariance, otherwise you've written on the most general Lagrangian. Consistent with,
of course, of course here we assume that it's just all three invariant, of course.
Okay.
Sorry, I have a question. Is that valid at two loops? I mean, you haven't done the two calculation, but do you have any reason to think that it's valid at two loops?
Two loops?
Higher orders in the beta function?
Higher loops will restrict the symmetry?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have that higher fixed point. I mean, is this just an accident of these one loop diagrams by something that I don't quite see, but it's maybe a hidden?
I don't think that it's accident. Of course, I mean, we haven't done the two loop calculations, but I don't expect that this stability will be removed by two loop order effect.
So that would imply that there's something underlying it, right? That there's something enforcing it, other than just you just calculate these diagrams and they just happen to get
Yeah, very, very good, actually. I mean, of course, I mean, actually, one of the reasons why this happens is the type of interaction we consider here. So, for example, if you consider, if you would consider some other form of interaction, for example, if you put here gamma zero, in general, you wouldn't expect this to happen. So, of course, I mean, this result also depends on the type of interaction you are considering.
So you're sure you haven't somehow this not an implicit hidden symmetry been slipped into this Lagrangian to enforce this? If you really believe this happens at all higher loops, that would really strongly apply to the hidden symmetry.
The problem is that I really didn't do the two loops, so I cannot tell for sure that this will continue to hold. However, I don't expect that this the higher order loops will ruin our result.
So, Mark, I don't understand your question. I mean, obviously, CF equal to CG has Lorentz symmetry, so there's an... If you have Lorentz symmetry, then nothing is going to destroy it, so...
No, but it's the beta
company's wondering if the beta functions are going to maintain that fixed point when higher order corrections occur. And if they do, then that suggests there's a hidden symmetry.
Yeah.
And if they do not, then it's not a fixed point. That's the problem, basically.
Yeah, that's the difficulty with the claim.
So it's not that... So you're not worrying about the stability, you're worrying about that there is the fixed point if you include higher order.
Yeah,
stable fixed point.
Another way of phrasing it, yeah.
Yeah,
of course.
Either it is true at all loops, and then you're just kind of putting the symmetry by hand, and I don't understand the significance of the result, or it's not true, and then there isn't a fixed point.
I mean, maybe, I mean, the idea that we always think, I mean, don't to think that actually the symmetry, that there should be a symmetry out there in order to find, to get the result, but you can think of it the other way around. Maybe all these, all, if all these higher order loops, all right, will give your CF equal to CG and IR fixed symmetry, then this is the way to think why our world looks to have this Lorentz symmetry. It's just a, it, like flipping our way of thinking.
Yeah, but however, this is, you know, my personal bias. So in all these business about emergence, I mean, it's never clear to me when you're playing a fair game. That is, you know the theories, they are there, they have these nice properties, you want to see they are coming in. All of a sudden, you begin to look for analog systems where you can begin to see this structure coming out. But you, I mean, you have this knowledge in the back of your mind, as you
yes.
mentioned. If you
yes, 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 true.
If you put there, things will change. So
of course. I completely agree with you, of course. And we found, actually, that there are only few kind of structures in this Lagrangian that can give rise to IR Lorentz symmetry, and if you change this structure, of course you run away from Lorentz in invariance, definitely. And this is a challenge of like people who like to build top-down approach to emergence in order that they have to kill these bad operators, if you would like, that give rise to violation of Lorentz symmetry. So, actually, we also continue to study the same system for the most general...
Just before you... Where did the standard base function for the imagine here? How are you running these systems?
How?
What are they running? You should be, I expect to also to see a standard base function for QE.
Of course, for the E, for the charge E.
And what does it look like?
Yeah, I will come to this point in a moment, of course. It will be it's exactly given by the same structure, actually. I mean.
Because it's not a fixed point. It's only a fixed point for some of the equations.
Yeah, I know. But actually, I mean, in this, if you consider the length where CG and CF are very small compared to 1, all right? So they are just, sorry, 1 plus some small correction, then actually the beta function of the coupling constant will not be altered. All right. So in this general system here, we consider the interaction between NF different fermions and NG different bosons. And we studied also the smallest eigenvalue of the beta functions, which govern the behavior of the system. And we find here that it is always positive, which means that there is a stable point where all the different speeds of the fermions is equal to the all the different speeds of the bosons. And here we see that this eigenvalue increases as you increase the number of fermions, a result that will become important in a few minutes. All right, so let me summarize what we have done. So
we just parameterize the difference between one and the speed of the bosons and the fermions by the parameter eta. So in this case, the general structure of eta takes the following form. Here, eta equal to 0 is an IR fixed point, which means that we have an emergent Lorentz symmetry. So if G is constant, we can find that eta just runs according to a power law running, all right? However, as you have just mentioned, that actually the coupling constant itself runs. All right, and if we take this coupling constant into consideration, we find that eta itself runs logarithmically. Now we are in trouble. Why? Because if you assume that eta is of order 0.1 at the UV or the emergent scale, if you don't want high fine tuning, and if you require your eta to be as small as 10 to minus 14, then we find that there should be an emergent scale of order 10 to 10 to 13 GeV, which is ridiculously bigger than anything interesting for phenomenology. V is just some number, could any number of order 1. Yeah. So in order to cure this problem, let us imagine the following scenario. Let us assume that we have a number FNF of fermions greater than or equal to 1, in addition to a huge number of gauge fields, U1. And in the same time, we will assume that all the fermions emerge at some UV scale with a common speed CF star, and all gauge bosons will emerge with a common speed CG star. In addition, we assume that the fermions have the same initial charge E star under the different gauge fields. So under these three assumptions, all we need to do is just to repeat the calculations, considering NG bosons and NF fermions. And we can just integrate our RG equations to find the following form for the coupling constant E and the ratios between the speeds. So the running of E just happens as usual, logarithmically. Here, NF is of order 1 or so, so we have exactly the same situation like in QED. However, now the ratios between the speeds is given by the coupling constant at the IR divided by the coupling constant at the UV to the power NG over NF. So if you take NG much larger than NF, you can actually suppress this ratio to meet the stringent constraints on eta. So, for example, if you take your emergent scale to be of order 10 to 16 times the IR scale, so if you consider the IR scale to be of order 1 TeV, then this is the Planck scale in this case. And we actually find that there is some parameter space that satisfies this requirement, which is given by the green area here. So this green area satisfies that eta has, can be smaller than 10 to minus 14. However, we also have to make sure that our theory respects the perturbation analysis, which is given by the yellow region here. And the red region is the intersection between these two regions, which is the allowed parameter space. So we came up with this, model. It is not a realistic model, but it's just a model that shows that this can actually happen. It's the number of gauge bosons.
So you need lots of gauge bosons.
Yeah, around from 500 to 1,000 to achieve.
And I can't see the scale of the fermions. How big
is this? Is from 1 to 6.
Oh, so you don't need too many fermions. So the smallest number of gauge bosons is like 50 or something?
No, actually it is around 250 or something like
that.
That's
small. All right, so you need tons of gauge bosons.
Yeah.
So where are they then?
Okay, actually they are, okay, so we will assume that they are massive, and because of that they will actually decouple from the RG.
So the idea is that if you go slightly above TB, you should see like hundreds of gauge bosons.
Yes. All right. Actually, we can also relax the perturbativity condition. And in this case, we can actually have eta of order 10 to minus 14, if you consider NF of order 100 and NG of order 1000, even if mu star over mu IR of order only 100, which actually opens the possibility that many copies of the hidden sector may suppress Lorentz violating effects already present at the TEB scale.
Sorry, why do you have NF as about 100? I thought you said you'd get away with half a dozen.
Yeah, I mean, all right, I mean from one, okay, if you like, it's from 1 to 100, right? But in this case, you have actually to absolutely, like, assume that your theory, I mean, your theory becomes non-perturbative in this case. And so here you have to assume that there's some kind of, like, non-perturbative RG that can solve
this. So you're saying typical numbers that would give you that constraint on eta or eta are 100 fermions and 1,000 gauge.
Right. Yeah.
So, but it's not only the ratio. Oh, no, sorry. It's not just the ratio, right?
No, it's not just the ratio.
In order to also, you have also to satisfy the requirements on E itself. It has to be, I mean, for the 1 over 1 to 129 in the TEB scale range.
So in that, you just worried about, that's the QED coupling, right?
Yes.
But what about the others? Did you have to worry about those at all?
Yeah, of course. In a complete theory, we should also worry about those, but we haven't considered
this. Yeah, but in the context of that model, this is what.
Yes, of course. All right. So at least I show that this can happen, all right? So that we can actually find an emergent Lorentz symmetry at the IR. And the other thing that I'm going to actually study is the possibility that gauge symmetry of nature is an emergent symmetry. And I will also put some experimental constraint. I will put some constraints on how likely the gauge symmetry is actually emergent. So, all right, so I need to redo this example. Just keep in mind that with any emergent symmetry, there could be some small violation of this symmetry. All right. So I will. We will test how likely these symmetries, or if you like to call them redundancies, are actually emergent. And actually, we think that any small deviation from an exact symmetry could be a smoking gun for emergence. So, if there is some deviation from an exact gauge symmetry, we should expect that this deviation is suppressed by a large scale. This is the usual way of thinking in effective field theory. However, we know that the large scale is the Planck scale. And gravity itself is suppressed by Planck scale. So if we were to see anything, then it is better to go and look in the gravitational sector, because it is more sensitive to the immersion or to the immersion phenomena or to the emergence of some small deviation.
Well, people before have studied the gravity with broken Lorentz, so I'm not going to touch on this today. However, they didn't actually consider in this, the same amount of studies for the general for the breaking of general covariance, which is sometimes called the general coordinate transformation or the invariant or the diffeomorphism invariance. And people have only studied the breaking of diffeomorphism invariance in the case of massive gravity or Baudy-Pierce theories of gravity. So in another work with John Donohue and Ufuk Aydemir, we tried to take an effective field theory framework to actually study the deviation from a perfect diffeomorphism invariance. And in this framework, all we need to do is just write down all operators consistent with the symmetry that we assume, which is Lorentz. So we are going to assume Lorentz, and we are going to break the diffeomorphism invariance. So in the top of the general relativity, the Einstein-Hilbert action, we will consider small terms that break the diffeomorphism invariance. And we will consider this on the top of Minkowskian background. So the first term that we can write is the dimensional two operator, which is the massive gravity. And we know that this term can potentially have Gauss, which are terms with wrong sign for the kinetic terms. And in order to see that, all we need to do is just to use a Schickelberg trick So we just sim the HMU nu to partial nu to some scalar phi, and we find that there is some higher order operator. We have to exercise these Gauss, and we just choose A plus B equal to zero. This is called the Baoyi-Pierce theories of gravity. And however, we see that because of the lack of diffeomorphism invariance, these terms come and haunt us again if we consider loop corrections. Anyway, so the other problem is what is called the VDVZ discontinuity.
I guess theoretically you would expect that the radiative fractions would give A plus B not equal to zero, but I mean, that kind of depends on the UV completion of the theory, doesn't it?
I mean, if you just write down some loop diagram without diffeomorphism, why you wouldn't expect this to happen? I mean, it will be generated.
Well, and if there is some other symmetry in the theory that keeps you at that point.
All right, if there is, but if you don't assume other symmetry, then this.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess the reason I say that there's this theory of so-called cascading gravity that people have developed here, and that reduces to massive gravity at the linear level.
I see.
But the claim is that it's ghost free, basically.
I see. Well,
actually, also this theory suffers from what is called the VDVZ discontinuity, which is the wrong prediction for the light bending. So this can be shown just by writing down the propagator for the GR and comparing it to the propagator of Baoyi-Pierce. Here in GR, we find the factor minus 1, and in the case of Baoyi-Pierce, we find the factor of 2 over 3. This just tells us this gives us the wrong prediction for the deflection of light. So basically, essentially, people are inclined to put M equal to 0 in this kind of gravity. All right, now if we go ahead, then we can also enumerate all the higher order operators that can actually break diffeomorphism invariance, so we can write down or list all the 3 and 4 dimensional operators. However, we will only constrain limit our studies to the dimensional 4 operators and with only 2 derivatives. So, yes?
I have a question about sort of the philosophy. So, with the gauge symmetry, you can always restore it by using
exactly, as you mentioned, but in this case you have to increase the number of degrees of freedom in your system, right?
So can't I do that, and then what? How do I reconcile that with your approach of saying that asymmetry is emergent?
All right, perfect. So, however, when you use this trick, that is called Strickelberg trick, you introduce other degrees of freedom in your system, right? So we are not going to do that.
I can do that.
You can do that, exactly. You can do that, but I'm not going to do that. So all I'm going to
what you're doing is you're constraining also, instead of just constraining a theory of gravity, you're constraining a theory of gravity plus some other degrees of freedom. I can interpret it that way.
You can, yes.
So but just to add, in that language, it means that those extra degrees of freedom decouple at low energy. So that's... So they only exist at high energies.
I guess that's something you have to check, right? I
mean, you have to check, but then so if your theory is emergent, if your guesstimate is emergent, that means all extra degrees of freedom decouple at low energies, right? Or in the limit that you're interested in. So that means that they are not there. So the theory without those degrees of freedom has the guesstimate. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
All right, so what we can do in this case is that in top of GR, we just write down all the dimensional four operators with 2 derivatives, with these coefficients AI, which are very small coefficients compared to 1. So here I just enumerate all the different Lagrangians that are of 2 derivatives. And we see that L6 and L7 can actually be written in terms of L1 and L2 by division by parts.
So all we are going to consider are just Lagrangian from L1 to L4. And after that, we just go and do linearized analysis. So we just write g mu nu as eta mu nu plus h mu nu. We write down the equation of motion. It's not important now what that means, but just what we need to do after that is just to assume that there is a conserved energy momentum tensor. And once we assume that, we get the following equation. So for general values of AI, we find actually there is a constraint that has to be satisfied if this theory is to be consistent, which is the divergence of H is equal to 0, in addition to that A4 is equal to A5. And now in order to study if there is a DVDZ-like discontinuity in our theory, we just go and do some, we find the propagator. So the propagator has the following structure with A, B, C, having the following form. Here you see just by naked eyes that if you just send the A1 through A4 to 0, you don't actually get any kind of like discontinuities, DVDZ-like discontinuities. So our theory predicts the correct behavior of light bending. However, here we bring the diffeomorphism invariance. So whenever you break diffeomorphism invariance, you should expect the other degrees of freedom to appear. So we should expect tensors, vectors, and the scalars. The tensors are the gravitons. Vectors actually do not interact with matter if we assume that the matter is conserved. However, the scalars are a little bit worse because there could be ghosts. So in order to hunt for these ghosts, all we have to do is that we sandwich the propagator between two lumps of matter, T mu nu 1 and T mu nu 2, and then decompose this expression into this form. So the first part actually gives the spin 2 contribution, as I have just mentioned, that the vectors decouple, and what is left is just the scalar contribution. So in order to make sure that this is not a ghost, then this term has to come with the positive sign. And in this case, this combination of A's has to be less than or equal to 0.
Worry about the vectors because they'll screw up gravitational radiation. They'll drain energy like crazy from the binary pulsar system. Even if they don't interact with anything else, they feel the rest of gravity and they'll suck energy out of gravity waves.
The scalars.
No, vectors.
Vectors.
Yeah.
I see.
There's tight constraints on dipole radiation, energy loss due to dipole gravitational radiation, and I'm pretty sure those guys are going to have some.
I see.
So I think you need to constrain that as well.
I see.
Even if they don't talk to the rest of matter.
Anyway, just in a minute, I'll show
that keep going.
Yeah, we'll show that there's actually very strict constraint that would like restrict everything. So the first thing is to do is just to study light bending. And we find that the light bending gives the following result. And this just by comparing to the experimental data, we find that A has to be as small as 10 to minus 5. All right?
All the A's?
I mean, here we don't assume an inner relation between the A's. And because of that, we just find that a generic value of A has to be as small as 10 to minus 5. But this is not enough, okay, as you have mentioned. All right, so we have to go and do a full nonlinear analysis for this problem. And for this thing, we are going to consider only the effect of one of the Lagrangians, which is L of 3. We believe that the rest are the same. So this is the full nonlinear equation. The first two terms are just the GR contribution, and the N is actually the diffeomorphism breaking term. So again, we assume that the energy momentum tensor is conserved. And from geometry, we have Bianchi identity. So we end up with this constraint on M mu nu, which is equivalent to the divergence of H alpha beta equal to 0 in the case of linearized theory. We have to have this constraint in order to have a consistent theorem. And in order to do this nonlinear analysis, we have to do the post-Newtonian formalism. So why we do post-Newtonian? First of all, to find the exact solutions for our theory is kind of very difficult. And if we depart from spherical symmetry, then the problem becomes almost impossible. So we need a systematic way to test the theory beyond Newton, which is the post-Newtonian. So, yes.
You
neutrons you were adding, they were suppressed by one power of M Planck, is that right, or was it?
Yeah, okay, good. So actually, they exactly, yeah, they are suppressed by M Planck, but they have exactly the same structure like the GR terms. So actually, GR is just L1 minus L2.
Ah.
So all these terms have exactly the same structure. They just come with different indices, with different combination for the indices, so that their general structure, it breaks the diffeomorphism invariance.
Suppressed then by...
They are not suppressed by additional scale. They are suppressed by the direct scale, exactly like in GR.
Right. And is there any symmetry that's left here, or is it
just... Lorentz symmetry.
Oh, there's Lorentz symmetry.
Yes. You assume that Lorentz symmetry is there. Of course, this is just to simplify our calculations. Because anyway, Lorentz symmetry has been constrained before. All right, so in the post-Newtonian formalism, this is just a perturbation, systematic perturbation analysis, where we use velocity of a perfect fluid, V, as our expansion parameter. So all we need to do is just to write G00, G0i in the top of the Minkowskian background, so we just expand it like G00 order 2, which means it is of order V squared, G00 to order 4, which means it is of order V to the 4, etc. We do the same for the Riemannian curvature tensor, Ricci tensor, and the same for the diffeomorphism breaking tensor as well. But in addition to that, we have also to do the same thing for the constraints, which actually introduce a big mess in our calculations. So we can find Gij and G0i to order 2 and 3 respectively. However, in order to convert to the solar system, this we have to go and do G00 to order 4, which is really a big mess if you consider in addition the constraints on this equation. All right, so after some long and tedious work, we find the following final form of G004. Here you... phi w, phi 1, phi 2 are all what is called gravitational potentials. And actually, we found actually there are also some new potentials that were not, that don't exist in the conventional theories of gravity. So after that, all we need to do is just to compare the G00 to the G00, what is called parameterized post-Newtonian formalism, which is a general form of G00 written in terms of 10 different parameters. And these parameters have already constrained by looking into the solar system data. So they are gamma, beta, psi, whatever, alphas, and zetas. So gamma, for example, this is the light deflection parameter. And beta is the Brillouin shift. This, I believe this is psi, or... this is a preferred location effect, and the alphas are preferred frame effects, while the alpha 3 and the zetas are actually measure the violation of the conservation of the total momentum. So we find actually that the most severe constraint comes from the parameter alpha 3, which measures both the preferred frame effect and the violation of the conservation of the total energy and momentum. And this alpha 3 was constrained before by looking into the timing of binary pulsars, and was constrained to be of order 10 to minus 20. And this puts severe constraints on our alpha, on our A's. So our A's generically have to be as small as 10 to minus 20. In other words, that it tells us if gauge symmetry is to be emergent, one has to be very, very careful at the UV. Or in other words, that maybe the diffeomorphism invariance actually is emergent, but in an exact way in the IR.
If these A's are suppressed by powers of M Planck, then I don't see, like, if you are able to be something like energy divided by M Planck, and so binary pulsar, it's huge. So. Isn't that what you expect in any emergency?
But these A's are just dimensionless coefficients.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you recover exact symmetry in infrared, you expect these deviations from symmetry to be suppressed by powers of M Planck, right?
You mean additional powers of M Planck?
I
didn't get your question.
Yeah, additional powers are fine.
Yeah, like this is if you write down an operator that already is higher order dimension.
Yeah.
But we just constrained, of course, you would expect that if you write down like five dimensional five operators.
You think this is not higher order? This is
the they are not higher order, they are exactly the same order like in GR. Alright, so you just, I will come to the conclusion. So, emergent phenomena is actually relatively new and deserves more study, at least in my opinion. We adopted a phenomenological procedure to study the emergence, and our studies may indicate that if gauge invariance is emergent, like in the case of gravity, then it might be emergent, but in an exact way. And actually, we also introduced a mechanism to build models for an emergent universal speed of light. And still, some more phenomenological tests are on the way. Thank you.
So I'll ask this now. I was waiting. I mean, this limit of eta being less than 10 to the minus 14, we don't really know that that implies a universal speed of light. I mean, most subatomic particles are unstable, and we really don't know if their limiting speeds are the same as the speed of light, except indirectly insofar as standard QFT agrees. But there
yes.
could be a lot of play in the error bars. So. It seems to me you could loosen this consideration and just say, what's the tolerance? Maybe all particles really do have different limiting speeds up to some tolerance level, and then you don't run into quite the level of constraint.
Right, exactly. I agree with you. And actually, the philosophy is the following, that, okay, this running happens because of the coupling between different fields.
So the stronger the coupling, you should expect the smaller the deviation between the two different speeds, right? So you should expect the tolerance on eta to be the biggest in, for example, in systems where the interaction is the weakest, like for example, gravitational system. So in this case, we think that maybe studying the gravitational the speed of the gravitational waves can give the loose. Or less severe constraint on eta in this case.
We have from cosmic rays. I'm just saying that, for example, the equivalence principle is generally thought to say it's satisfied to 1 part in 10 to the 12. That all that experiment tells us is that neutrons and protons couple to gravity the same way
yeah,
that
right.
tolerance.
Right.
When you go down to electrons, you lose 4 or 5 orders of magnitude. And when you go to other unstable subatomic particles, we don't know.
Right.
So maybe you're asking for too much here. Maybe you should just say that I don't actually need to reach a universal speed. I just need everybody
perfect.
To be
okay.
similar to within 1 part in 10 to the 8 or something.
All right, perfect.
But then that would not... Seems to me it's worth looking at that phenomenologically, if nothing else.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I have a question that goes back to Brian's question. Can you comment on what's the difference between when you consider a symmetry to be emergent and when you just have a symmetry that's like nonlinear and you realize with lifted partners ever in that?
Wait, nonlinearly realized?
Yeah.
Like, can you explain more? But
Well, you can have something like, say, for example, the Higgs mechanism, like nice linear single model. You can integrate the Higgs out of the theory, and
yep.
then you still will have the same symmetry structure, but it's not as apparent.
Exactly.
It's all overrun.
Exactly.
You get
exactly.
confused unless you realize what's going on.
Right.
And you know you just break down some effective
phenomenological right. Right.
theory,
True.
Which has that
True.
Sort of non-linear realized
exactly. symmetry. Exactly. 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 Right.
So how is that different? What is
I mean, in principle, you could do that.
How can I tell the difference between these two things?
All right. I mean, this is...
I don't think you can from the bottom of the approach.
I don't think so either. That's why I'm confused.
But this is a perfectly fine way to describe, I guess, emergence.
I mean, again, here, I mean, there is one important point.
Is there a real difference between these two things?
Well, it's the same Lagrangian, so...
It seems like
it. It would be the same Lagrangian from
the problem is how you v complete the Lagrangian.
Right.
The problem is you introduce these extra degrees of freedom. But I believe that there is no single way of introducing them. So there will always be some kind of, okay, there could be some different COV completions for your theory.
And you're saying that emergence is when the UV completion of all the extra...
No, 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 I didn't say that at all.
I didn't actually finish my sentence. So I'm not sure if you said it. Are you saying that emergence is when you have these other degrees of freedom, and you have more than those other degrees of freedom, and you still get this low energy symmetry? Is that your statement? Or is that...
I'm not going to make this statement. At all I have been doing is actually just to say, okay, let's assume that diffeomorphism invariance is broken, or energy invariance is broken by some small piece. Alright? In principle, I can lift the breaking of the diffeomorphism invariance by using this Stoeckelberg trick, or introducing new degrees of freedom in my system, right? But I just choose not to do that. All I have done is just, all right, I will take the Lagrangian as it is and just compare it to the data.
I think with gauge symmetries, I mean, all that matters is that the number of degrees of freedom in your system. Like with electromagnetism, the point is that physically there are 2 degrees of freedom.
Yes.
And you introduce the gauge symmetries for convenience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the same thing can be done. All that you're constraining is like how many degrees, the physical degrees of freedom in your system.
Yeah, but the difference is whether, I mean, the theory is local or non-local. I mean, that's, so if you just try to write a theory with 2 degrees of freedom without this auxiliary, without the gauge degrees of freedom, it would be a non-local theory, right? Yeah, I'm just saying you cannot just write a local theory for photon with 2 degrees of freedom, because you have to include the gauge degrees of freedom. Otherwise, you cannot write the local action for it.
I don't know if there's a gauge where I can go with two degrees of freedom. There's two physical degrees of freedom. I'm not sure if you can move some gauge fixing. Physically, the point is that 2 degrees of freedom.
Physically, so sure. Physically, that means the physical is a freedom. So are you saying that gauge symmetry, there is no physical meaning for gauge symmetry? Is that what you're
saying? In some sense.
It's perilously close to it. A common statement that's made. Yeah.
But I mean,
this is the redundancy versus it being a real symmetry thing.
But so that's the point I'm trying to make, that I think at least at the mathematical level, at least in the practical level, there's a difference. That if you try to write a theory without these fake degrees of freedom, then it would be non-local. Right?
Not necessary. No, I mean, you take even the massive QED,
mm-hmm.
You already can restore the gauge invariance by introducing your scalar phi to your theory. It doesn't really like have a physical degree. It is not a physical degree of freedom. But just it's just redundancy in your Lagrangian. So it introduces some.
So that's what. So your Lagrangian has the gauge symmetry. But my point is that if you try to get rid of all the gauge degrees of freedom, then what you end up is non-local.
Is that true? You can't write it in such a way that it's...
But it's the same as gauge fixing. So all the gauge fixings are... I mean,
they're not always... There are local gauge fixings. I believe. I mean, that's standard.
I don't know what he's saying. I'm more with Brian. I'm not understanding why he's saying that.
No, but can you write an action for electromagnetism that completely gets rid of the gauge, only has physical degrees of freedom in it?
I haven't thought about it for a while. But
yes.
But your theory, though, your theory of emergent gravity is equivalent to a theory with a graviton plus a other degrees of freedom.
Yes, in some sense, yeah. Right. Exactly. So you can decompose them into tensors, vectors, and scalars, of course, yeah. The problem is how first you introduce this redundancy. I mean, it is not obviously easy. I mean, it's not obvious to me how you do it. I mean, it is always a claim. You can always do it. I mean, there are two examples, like as you mentioned, the nonlinear UV completion of the XOE theory, for example, or in just the massive electrodynamics. However, for this case of gravity, it's not obvious to me at all how you introduce this extra degrees of freedom in a consistent way. Could be done, but I don't know how.
questions?
Sanjeev, I wanted to talk to you at some point. I'm sorry I didn't have much time so far because I'm teaching this semester, so I'm really busy. But so you're here until the end of the week?
Friday, yeah.
Yeah, so...